This is the Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency with information for IT professionals. For more information and to download other shows, visit www.ciaops.com/N2K. This is episode 10 with George Sergio. Welcome along to another Need to Know podcast. My name is Robert Crane, and today I'm joined by George Sergio from the consultant's coach over in the US. George, how are you?
I'm all right, Robert. How are you?
Excellent today. I thought that what we'd do today is that this podcast will focus a bit more on the business side of the IT environment for those listening, because I think that's very critical, obviously, in these times, and that's why I've obviously tapped George to come on board and give us his experience. So what we might do, George, is if you can just give us a bit of a background of your business, where you've come from, and what you're doing at the moment.
Sure, not a problem. As far as my background goes, where I came from, I'm a technology person, just like anybody that's probably listening to this podcast. I have a degree in electrical engineering. I took that from college, where I actually had a business in college, and I kept building businesses from there, both on the technology side and some non-technology businesses. I really have a love for both technology and the management of companies, with a bigger passion for the company side. So after I built a whole bunch of these companies, I decided to turn it around and help other people that are like me, technology people that want to take that and turn it into something of their own, because it's usually the hardest thing to do. I mean, none of us were really educated on the business side. So it becomes difficult to bridge that gap and try to get into a business mindset. And I just like it that much and learned it along the way and got some help along the way enough that I said, well, I know this isn't the easiest thing in the world to do. So maybe it's time to turn around and help people do it. And that's when I started Action Business Partners in 2003. And I decided to take on technology business owners, mostly in the IT space, that wanted to build their business. Either some are startups, some of them been in business for 2, 3, 20 years, all different stages of life, and take them from where they are now to whatever their goals are, and make it at least twice as fast as you would do it by yourself, because we take away most of the learning curve. So it's part education and it's part actual assistance and advice and coaching along and making sure people do what they need to do and get it done as fast and the best way possible. So that's basically what I do right now.
So the services that you provide for your clients are basically mentoring, advice. Would that be correct?
Yep. It's, some people look at it in different ways. Again, they call it coaching, they call it advising, they call it consulting, call it whatever you want, but that's basically what it is. It's taking some sets of goals, determining where the problems are, why they're not being met, and then putting the structure together to get it done and actually helping along and filling the gaps to get it done. Because most of the time, the problem is if you're not planning, that would be step one that most people don't do. And then step two, other people get to the planning part, but they don't execute. Sometimes it's fear, sometimes it's just lack of knowledge or a skill set or something like that. So we figure out what that issue is, and we make sure the execution happens as well.
Okay, so I think that where I first came across George was at SMB Nation 2008, with run by obviously Harry Brelsford. I think that the session that most interested me was one that George ran called "Run It Like You're Going to Sell It." I think that it was something that resonated very much with me at the time. I was in the process of transitioning into something different, but many of the topics and stuff that you covered in that presentation, I think, were really excellent, and they a lot of technology people should be paying attention to that. So can you give us a sort of a brief overview or a brief intro as to what that was about, George?
Sure. And it doesn't matter what kind of a business it is, although I deal with some particular types of companies in the IT service and consulting companies, any kind of business, you really should have some kind of exit goal, exit strategy in mind. And my personal opinion is to have the exit strategy of selling, even if you never plan on selling, and that's where the run it like you're going to sell it comes from, because there's many different kinds of exit plans, and any business should have an exit plan, whether it's I'm going to run it until I literally die, or I'm going to give it to my family, or whatever it happens to be. That's still an exit strategy, and you should plan the way you're structuring your business around that. But ultimately, planning to sell, whether it's 20 years in the future or a couple of years down the road, will always maximize how much money you can make now. It sets you with the structure that you need to have something that somebody would want to buy, and then allows you to get as much business value inside of that company over that time period, so you do have something to sell. So that's really the premise of run it like you're going to sell it, and the presentation itself.
So I think the thing is that, you know, a lot of people probably have read the E-Myth, which talks about something similar. I think that probably one of the things that is different is your focus on the need to do it immediately, basically to look at making your business as profitable and as enticing to someone from the outside as you can from, you know, this moment going forward. Because you know, like I said, most people probably fail to execute. Most people have got lots of excuses as to why they can't do things. So again, it's something that basically needs action straight away in some sort of form so that you can be moving forward with that. Would that be a fair, you know, a fair observation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it does everything that you want a business to do for you. I mean, there's two reasons to get in a business, and they do go together. One, you want to do some good, and you're something that you're good at or something that you have a passion for. But two, you're in it to make money, unless you're in a nonprofit. If you're dealing with a nonprofit company, then you're not there to make money. You're just there to do good and spend all the money you can. So if you put those two things together, there's no reason why you shouldn't do the best you possibly can for your customers or clients and also maximize how much money you make. I mean, it's the only thing that's going to set you up to have that business value, as well as make the money at the same time, as well as really one of the things that I talk about is a self-made insurance policy, which most people don't realize. Nobody likes dealing with insurance, but why not deal with an insurance policy that you don't really have to buy, and it's actually doing something for you now because it's putting more money in your pocket. So if you plan your business around the possibility of selling at one point or another, then if something bad happens, God forbid, and it does happen more often than not, it could be a divorce, it could be a partner getting sick, it could be you getting sick, another family member getting sick. Something bad could happen, and it happens more often than people like to admit, and it forces you to say, I have to get out of this business. And if you haven't done this self-made insurance policy that said, okay, maybe I didn't want to sell way down the road, but I was kind of prepping my company the whole time, then when that happens in the middle of nowhere, you actually have something to sell. It's really sad when people come to me and they're in that position and they say, I really have to sell. What can you do to help me? And, you know, the shorter the timeline you have to get rid of a company, the less money you're going to get. And a lot of people end up with absolutely nothing. And I try to help people avoid that absolutely nothing scenario.
So would you say that most, you know, we'll focus on the technology provider, would you say that most technology providers are just running their business with the idea they'll run it till they retire? Or do you think that they're actually looking to turn it over and maybe make some money or merge, or, you know, are they doing it more as a hobby than actually as a business?
I would say there's more companies out there than there should be doing it as a hobby versus a business. I think the economy has weeded most of those people out, or they will be gone within the next couple of years. It's not really the way to do it. You're not going to see it all that often anymore. Those people are not going to be able to compete with people that are really paying attention to their business. But at the same token, although the true businesses are coming out more and more versus the hobbyists, you still see many people not thinking until way in the future about what their future is going to be. They're so worried about the now and next week that they're never getting the bigger picture. They're never really acting like a true entrepreneur, which is the real goal that I try to get people to go from contractor, hobbyist, to business owner, to entrepreneur, where you're thinking and you're looking for the next thing that's going to help your company. You know, you stabilize what you can here and then you look for the next thing. Most people are stuck with the stabilize now, and they're not doing a good job of that. So this type of subject is way off the radar. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I did do a survey at one point, and most of the people on there weren't considering a sale for a long time, but at the same time, they were doing nothing to prepare for it at all. And the odds are they're going to wait until the last second to do that, and they're not going to be happy with the results.
Is it also a case, I mean, obviously you're in that business, so I probably can expect, you know, you'll agree with this statement, but would it be fair to say that, you know, especially when you're a smaller operator, that you should be looking to get, you know, external advice, external, your peers, you know, peer reviews, and maybe somebody totally out from left field, a business mind, looking over your business and giving you some advice and sort of saying, look, you know, you're doing this wrong, or have you thought about this, have you thought about that? Do you find that most people tend to be so insular that they think, oh, I know everything about business, my business is going really well?
I think this particular industry that we're talking about is very problematic with that, because we're all pretty smart, logical people, and we pick up technology stuff so quickly and easily that we kind of think by osmosis we're going to pick up the business stuff. And for most people, that's not the case, especially if you're not really interested in it. You're not going to get it. And I don't see a lot of people doing a good job of doing that. So that's why the peer groups do come into play. I'm not against any kind of peer group. I rather have one that's actually monitored by somebody that's not one of the peers, whether it's somebody, let's say, like myself or somebody along those lines who is not sitting in the same basket as everybody else. Because what happens is you get a ceiling at one point, everybody's going to ask the same question and nobody's got the answer. So you have to be careful with peer groups. If they don't have somebody moderating them, and it's not another peer, you're going to have some issues. But they do very well as long as everybody's matched up with each other. Same kind of company, same kind of models, same basic size, same basic experience. If you have somebody that's way more experienced than everybody else, that person is not going to like what's going on in a peer group, because they're going to get asked a lot of questions and they're not going to get a lot of help from everybody else. So basically they're going to get, well, pretty much not paid to help these people. And unless they're doing it for charity time, they're not going to want to be there. So peer groups are good, but they have their extensions that they can go to. Moderated groups, much better. I personally, I'm not a real fan, although I have my own versions of self-help stuff. I'm big into books. You know, I have my Build Your Own Business, Don't Be Your Own Boss book. I think it's a decent read for anybody. It's not a difficult read, but any kind of book like that, E-Myth, you know, general business books are good. That's sort of a self-help thing. But then there's a lot of other self-help things that even I have. I have a business blueprint self-help type of thing. I actually talk people out of buying it a lot of times, because you buy it, you might go over some things, and then after that, there's no execution, which is what I was talking about before. So people, they don't want help, but they do want help, but they want to do it themselves, but it's not going to happen. So it's a good first indicator that at least their frame of mind is changing, which is good, because they're trying to get the help by buying the self-help stuff, but the odds are it's going to sit next to their desk. And then the next version is the one-on-one stuff. And majority of what I do is one-on-one. Is it good for me or anybody else that does one-on-one? No, it's really not a good business model. But because I like what I do and I like the industry so much, and that I know that it's more important for somebody to get one-on-one help so that they can actually succeed in a peer group or some other kind of group, and in some cases just have a mentor checking in on them every once in a while, get them to the point where they don't have to work with somebody 2, 3, 4 hours a month. It could just be, again, like a board, whether it's paid or unpaid, so they can get to that level. But if you don't have that basis, then a board and everybody else is not going to help you. A peer group is not going to help you, but everybody should have somebody. I mean, even if you take professional athletes, if they didn't need any help, there'd be nobody called a coach on the team. You know, Tiger Woods, whether you like him or not, he's a good golfer, but he still has a coach that nobody knows the guy's name. But obviously there's things that happen where you get out of line, and somebody, it's easier for somebody else to see that you're off target and figure out why you went off target than you trying to do it yourself. So anything that can make yourself quicker into readjusting, that's what you want to do. And usually having somebody or some kind of entity looking over your shoulder, whether it's just a little bit or on a regular basis, is always going to help somebody, no matter what portion of their life they're in with their business, from a startup to 20, 25 years in the business. It doesn't matter.
Okay. And I think that something else that you did mention, I think, in that talk that did stick with me, was the fact about where you talked about, you know, if you're a golfer and you want to raise your or improve your handicap, you don't play with people who you can beat. You play with people who beat you all the time.
Absolutely. You know, you're absolutely right. I did say that.
and lift. The idea is to lift your average, and that can be very hard for, especially people in this industry, because, you know, if you become a specialist in one level of technology, you tend to you know, keep using that rather than forcing yourself outside your comfort zone. I mean, I think that was a very resonant fact. I think that's something that a lot of people don't do. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. That pushing yourself out of the comfort zone, you won't do it yourself most of the time. You're right. It's something that most people won't do. So when you have somebody prodding you along to get out of that comfort zone and helping you, not just leaving you hanging there, that's the best way to do it. And then the analogy with the golf is what I use all the time. You know, if you can get your friends that play better than you to convince you to go out and play with them, I promise you, you become a better golfer. I know I personally play better with people that are better than me. I'll play a better game than I ever had all the time, and I'll pick some things up. But, you know, if I go out with people that aren't that good, I don't get any better. Just a matter of seeing who's worse.
Yeah,
that's really not helping anybody.
Well, I think that, again, it's looking at it as a business and wanting to drive it forward. And I think, as you say, too many people are focused on the here and now rather than, you know, looking beyond that, looking where they want to be. And then all of a sudden, things change. Like I said, the situation changes for whatever reason, and good chance is it will happen at some stage. And then it's too late to make that change, or you're not up to that level. So it's, you know, exactly something that needs to be, you know, people need to look at to improve their business, I think. So
yeah. And people don't like change. It's just
it's the normal thing.
Human nature. So if they are faced with change, they don't want to do it. And that's what's really funny about this industry, is because most of us are in this industry because it changes. And it's almost an oxymoron how you won't really look at your business in that respect, but technology wise it's always changing. It's a matter of, when do you change? You know, when does your client really need this new technology, which means you need to learn it and you need to know how to apply it. You know, it's got to happen sooner or later. So if you got the technology working like that, why you can't wrap your head around the fact that your business needs to move like that too, I don't really understand, but that's really what happens.
Well, what I find interesting now is with the changes towards the cloud, and, you know, it's a completely different mindset, and, you know, it does require perhaps leaving go of the infrastructure, the speeds and the feeds, with a lot of people very comfortable with. It seems to me that most technology people aren't comfortable with this cloud change, with this significant change. They happily want to sit back and do the things that they've always done and basically keep doing the on-site stuff. You know, again, maybe this is an indication that, again, they're very set in their ways. Is that sort of your experience, do you think?
Yeah, that is. And this is a great example of a huge change. Or if you just go back a couple of years with the whole managed services stuff, although it's been around for years, just as soon as the terminology came out, people got scared. And now as they're getting used to that, the cloud comes in. Now, the cloud's been around for years, too. You know, people talk about things like on-premise cloud. Back when I was doing a lot of IT stuff, that was called an intranet. I mean, it's been there. It's not like this is really super new stuff. I mean, things have been hosted for a long time. So it's just a matter of, yeah, you get used to certain things. But, you know, before people were doing a lot of in-house stuff with servers, there are still some people out there that never really dealt with a true server before, and they had to deal with it when servers came into play. You know, the technology changes. It's going to change every, you know, 5 to 10 years. In this case, it changed a little bit faster with the introduction of the cloud being so big. But again, it was there already. It's not like you couldn't see the writing on the wall. But people get entrenched in what they're doing, whether it's on the technology side or the business side, and you know, they just get nervous and they start fighting things that they don't need to fight. I mean, it's just not that this is a technology conversation, but it, as far as your business goes and changing your business structure or adjusting your business structure based on something like the cloud becoming bigger, well, that still depends on who you're servicing. You know, I'm very big on, and this is big for a selling point as far as selling your company, picking a niche or two or three to be good at, because it's easier to sell things. It's easier to service. You don't have to learn as many things. You don't have your people learning as many things. It allows you to build a lot more structure into it. So, again, you're building in that profitability and the business value. And you already know when these new technologies come out, when they do and do not apply to your clients. If you service 10 different kinds of industries, a couple of them might be ready to go to the cloud right now, and 7 or 8 of them aren't. So how do you deal with that? Do you put all the time and effort into the cloud stuff for that, you know, small chunk of clients because they're going to need it, or you do you lose them? So if you stay concentrated, you know, if you're in industry A, B, and C, well, new technology comes out, you check out the technology, you see how it fits your clients. The cloud itself is, you know, there's 3 different versions of the cloud. What version of that cloud your clients would need, you don't know what fits there. And if something does fit, okay, then you got to make the adjustment. If they don't fit in any cloud stuff, then you don't have to make the adjustment. I don't know why people get so nervous about it, but, you know, life is a lot easier in business. Your business life is a lot easier if you concentrate on certain areas and become an expert in those areas. This way, this, you know, nothing really will faze you that much. It's not that big of a deal when things change. You can roll with the punches a lot easier, and you can act like that entrepreneur that we were talking about before that says, oh, this is great. This is something new that I could do with my clients. Or, no, that's not something I have to worry about. I'll keep it on the back of my mind. But in a couple of years, yeah, maybe these particular clients it might work for, no matter what the technology is. But, you know, but people just get up in arms and they don't think of it that way. And I think a lot of it is because they are so spread out in the types of people that they're servicing. They're just going for a geographic region instead of being a hero, as I like to call it, in a couple of different niches. And again, it's better for profitability and it's better for your business value. So I don't really see why people don't do it, unless you live somewhere where there's not much around you. So all you can do is hope you're the only tech guy there, and you try to take that whole geographic region.
So is it a case of learning to say no?
Sometimes it is learning to say no. I mean, if you're concentrating in certain areas, it does make it a lot easier if somebody from outside those areas come in. You're not going after them. So if they come to you, if it fits what you want to do and they're willing to pay what you want to charge them and do things the way you want to do it, then it really is your decision to say yes or no. I mean, that's really the best position to be in.
And perhaps it's also a case of looking at some strategic alliance within your, you know, the peer group that you can, you know, comfortably hand off some of that work or refer it on with a commission or whatever, you know, building this network of people around you that can provide the total solution without you having to do every single little piece.
Well, yeah, well, it goes both ways as far as the going to a partner. It's either I deal with these particular types of niches and somebody came to me that isn't in that niche and it really doesn't help me to help them, so I'm going to bring them to somebody else. Or it could be this is what I concentrate on, and, you know, I'm in the IT infrastructure, but somebody needs a phone system. Well, I don't want to know how to do phone systems. So when my client is ready for them to get a new phone system, here's the different kinds that they can get that I recommend. And then when they say, okay, then I get a partner to come in and do that work. You're absolutely right. You stick to some core things, because the more spread out you get, the harder it is to actually make money and know where it's coming from.
Well, it's also a matter of you can't be across everything. There's just so much to be across.
You can't. But people will argue with me until they're blue in the face that that's not the case. And like I said, the only excuse you have is if you're sitting in the middle of a city and there's nothing around that city besides you and the people that are there. There's just nothing else to do. So you just got to go geographic, or else you won't make any money. If you're not in that boat, it doesn't make sense. And honestly, in the IT world that we're talking about, the fact that people can do work from one coast to the other in any given country, as long as the infrastructure is there for the bandwidth and whatnot, you better be ready to be a hero in a certain couple of niches, because you're going to find people that don't work anywhere near you start tapping into your area because you have things that fit their niche. Let's say like the medical niche. You know, you might find people from way across the country starting to try to get your clients or your potential clients because they can, and the technology is there. So it's got to be embraced. So the best way to combat that is not be everything to all people, but be that hero for those couple of niches. And you can do the same thing. You know, it's really not unfathomable. That's happening more and more. I'm hearing it all the time. It's just, you know, that's the way it works. So you got to be a real business owner, a real entrepreneur about this whole thing, because it serves you. That's the other thing I don't understand, how people, they don't understand that if you do the whole run it like you're going to sell it thing, it's good for you. It's the only really way to do it. Why would you fight anybody on that? Why does it not make any sense? Obviously, it struck a chord with you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter what business you're talking about. This all makes sense for any business. So, you know, that's why it's a main premise in my book. And the whole book is structured around the whole thing of what you need in place to maximize this value.
Well, speaking of that, why don't we get on to, you know, actually what's required to start putting together an exit strategy? I mean, what sort of things do you need to, you know, start thinking about and moving in that sort of direction? What do we need to start looking at?
Well, and again, the selling exit strategy, which is the one that I talk about the most, even if it's the I'm going to retire, run until I retire, if you still take that tact of selling it or building the business like you sell it, you're looking at four things. So let's just assume you really do want to sell the business. And these all make a big difference if you don't pay attention to them. You want to know what kind of a buyer, and we can go over the different kinds of buyers if you wish, how much you actually want to sell it for, when you want to sell it for. And then this is the part that most people forget about, because why would you even think about it? But what do you plan to do after the sale? Because what you plan to do after the sale actually starts setting up the structure that might happen when you go to sell it. It also might change your mind on what kind of buyer you're going for. If you just want to retire, well, most buyers that'll fit. But if you want to stay on as an employee, we're talking about a merger type of situation, because a lot of times an acquisition, they're only going to keep you for a certain amount of time and then you're going to leave. So if you want to work for another couple of years, maybe that'll work for you. If you want to keep a portion of the sale, a portion of the business for like a side income, maybe you want to sell it to an employee or you want to sell it to a family member. That's a conscious effort to think about that stuff. Maybe you just want to get as much money as you can so you can go start something else or put your money into another venture. Those are the options that you have. But each one of these, if you don't think about all four of them, you're not going to have a really solid exit strategy when you're talking about selling. So you're going to do yourself a disservice. And as much as the last one seems fluffy with what are you planning on doing after the sale, it's actually probably the most important one.
Yeah, because you've basically got to fill the rest of your days, haven't you? I mean, you know, it's your
life. Oh, absolutely.
To make you happy.
Right. Just because you want to sell the business one day doesn't mean you necessarily don't want to keep working. So, you know, there's many ways to think about it, but that plan will actually probably realign the first question of what type of buyer. So it almost should be the first question.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so what, just briefly, what sort of buyers, you know, would you say are out there?
Well, types of buyers, I mean, you have some investors, which is very rare. As far as a service business, a consulting business is concerned, they may have to be a pretty darn big company to get any kind of venture capital or to go public or something like that. But sometimes you will see some people who have some money and they want to throw it into a business. So you could possibly sell some equity in your company, you know, maybe sell 30, 40% of it, keep controlling interest and just infuse some money into your company or, you know, do a little cash out. That's possible. Not as easy to find. Sometimes it's just somebody that you might know that has a lot of money and needs to put it somewhere for a shelter or something like that. So again, it's not the normal way to go. But one of the more normal ones is a full-out acquisition. Sometimes that could be the same size company or bigger company, they're looking at rolling up. Maybe you have a service that they don't have, but they're in the same field in general. Or maybe you have a set of clients. Let's say you're in the medical side of managed services and they don't have that, and they don't want to start from scratch, so they'll acquire your company to do that. For the most part, with acquisitions, you don't usually stay on as an employee, but sometimes you can, and you'll do it in a no ownership type of role. So maybe you become the vice president of, you know, medical services in the managed service department. Other times, they just want you out. So you might stay for a little while for the transition and then get out. But sometimes if you're talking about a smaller company, all they want to do is come in and buy your assets, which your main assets are your clients. And then they'll keep you on as long as it takes to transition those clients. And then that's it. They won't take your employees and won't take anything. They just want your clients. That's fairly typical. And you got mergers where I guess we talked about that before, where you kind of go in with somebody else. Maybe you keep the majority share or they do. It could be done many different ways. And a lot of times that's another thing, just like the acquisitions, they're trying to get a bigger market share, maybe in a certain area. Maybe you're both the biggest players in the area and they want to turn it into one big company to take over the whole area. There's different reasons for it. And then, like we said before, the selling to families, employees, I'll tell you, this is the one that people, they mess it up a lot. There's more planning in selling to somebody that's in your company or a family member than any kind of other sale. And that's where you hear the word succession planning. And for the most part, it's planning and executing that plan. And most people don't do either one. And they end up not being real happy about that sale. Somebody makes out, but it's usually not the person that sold it. So definitely get help if that's the tact you want to take to sell to somebody that you know like that. And then you have selling it to somebody that's doesn't have a company yet. That's a fairly common one. If you don't have a really big company, the value is not really that big. It's a decent sized company. It has some infrastructure, but it's not huge. Somebody might come along that maybe they used to work for a huge company. They made a lot of money. They cashed out of that company, but they want to do something in your field. So they'll come in and basically buy you out. Or it might be that whole equity investor type of situation. You never know either way. And then the one that I think is the funniest is the wait till you get the offer you can't refuse, which I think it's funny because most of the people that say that are doing absolutely nothing to build any value into their business. And the only way you're going to get an offer you can't refuse is to have your company on somebody's radar because you're doing really well. And they can see that things run very smoothly in your company, regardless of how much money you're making revenue-wise. It could be a $500,000 company. It could be a $20 million company. It doesn't matter. If you're on their radar because they keep seeing you and seeing you and seeing you and you're popping up all over the place, well, that's when you're going to be able to get a good offer. And honestly, those are the people that usually make the most money on the sale. It's sort of like going to a bank. They're going to, when the economies are right, they're going to give you more money and more apt to give you a loan when you don't need the money. Same thing with selling a company. When you're not in a position where you need to or really want to sell a company, you're always going to have a higher value to somebody that sees a good company that doesn't need to be sold. So that's why those guys make more money.
And the bottom line is that you need to be putting yourself in a position where you can be ready to accept that offer, even if it doesn't come. You know, because again, the offer may be so good, but you may not recognize it at the time, or it may expire because you haven't put yourself in a position to maximize, you know, the returns or the investments you've made in your business.
Absolutely. That's exactly what happens.
Okay.
And it goes back to the insurance thing too.
Yeah.
You know, if you set it up already, you're going to be much better off than waiting till when you really think you want to get out.
Yeah, exactly. So what would you say, you know, I mean, I suppose, you know, what, in your experience, what are buyers looking for? What is a potential buyer really looking for in a business that they're going to pay money for?
Well, again, if you go back and look at what type of buyer you're looking at, they all have their different criteria. And you might actually take two buyers looking at the same company, and those two buyers are looking at it for the same reason. Maybe they both are doing it for an acquisition to get into a new market. And both of them could have 10 points of criteria they're looking for, five are the same, or five, and five of them are completely different as far as the metrics they're looking for. But even though they're completely different, in general, every one of these buyers are looking for a good structure inside of the company, things that are consistent that go on to business. You have systems and processes in place. You have some kind of growth in a bad economy. Even flat is nice, but some kind of stability and growth in your financials, some kind of diversity in your revenue, so you're not basically – you don't have all your eggs in one basket type of thing. You know, you got to be good and in niches, but you don't want to rely on one huge client. That's not good. Solid cash flow, which is often confused with having good top line and bottom line numbers, good revenues and good profits. Cash flow is totally different. You can have 20% profit margin and have bad cash flow, meaning you have money's going out a lot faster than it's coming in, which means you're missing some systems and processes. People are not paying you the way they should. That's a big sign of a problem most of the time. So that's not something good at all. Nobody's looking for that in general. But more importantly, anybody that's paying attention to what they're doing is not going to bother buying a business that's a job. They want an actual business where they can pluck you out and put themselves in there or put somebody else in there. That you, everything's not revolving around you. It's just not your job. Now, you can actually get a good chunk of money with a one-person show. And so nobody should think, well, I have one person. This makes no sense to me. It really does because, again, you're still maximizing your profitability, so why not put as much money in your pocket now as you can? But it makes your one asset that you have, which is your clients, worth a lot more money when somebody can go in and say, you really run this thing like clockwork. And these clients really like the way you do stuff. I think we can find a way to get you out of the way or transition you out, and these clients will make some money for us, so we're willing to pay you for that. So don't think a one-person deal, you know, can't get any money. It's not recommended. I mean, you're not going to get the most amount of money, but you can still run it like you're going to sell it when it comes to a one-person show. And that's the same stuff that everybody's looking for, that list. No matter what the buyer is, they all have their own criteria, but that's what they're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, if someone's willing to pay money for it and they see value in it, how it's structured doesn't necessarily make a huge amount of difference. If they see think about how many single man internet sites have been set up that someone's come in and bought and then merged into their business. I mean, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, they're looking for some kind of infrastructure, but they don't necessarily, you know, everybody's different. They could be looking for one man shows on purpose. But they still want something that says your clients are real clients. They understand what's going on. They pay you on time. Everything works the way it's supposed to. They're worth it. We can bring it into the fold and make money off of them. But if you got a company where you're running it like a job, people are paying you like a contractor, you know, like half the going rate of what most people are charging, then those clients aren't good. They're not good for anybody. Nobody's going to want to buy them. There is no structure. The structure says this is made for somebody that's an independent contractor. It's not a business. I don't want it.
Yeah. Okay. So I suppose that the next question is that, you know, really, how do you then start valuing business? I mean, how do you work out what the business is worth? I mean, it's an interesting question because, you know, there are intangibles. There are managed service contracts, for example. You know, how do you actually go about that? What's the process there?
Okay. Well, this is where a lot of people end up asking me questions. And unfortunately, if I'm not right in front of you with knowing the specifics of your company and your business model, there's only so many things I can really say. But in general, to get that value in the business, well, you got to know how things are valued. You got two pieces. You have the valuation, which is purely numbers driven, which most people think it stops there. And that's got so many quirks in it, it's not even funny as far as what people put towards valuation to come up with the number. But then you have an evaluation. And I'll tell you right now, if the valuation, the 100% best you can get on evaluation, if you go to do an evaluation, all the evaluation is going to do is make sure you're still getting that top number or it's going to erode it. It's never going to make it better. I'll tell you that right now. Evaluation is like what you were talking about before. What kind of contracts do you have? If it's a managed service company, how solid are those contracts? How many do you have? What kind of areas do you have it in? How do you handle the servicing of the things? Is it organized? Is it unorganized? How many people do you have working on it? How efficient are they? How long have you been in that niche? How long have you been in business? Where's your geographic location? All kinds of things that the buyer's looking for. those things I was saying before about, you know, what are the criteria? That's where the evaluation comes into play. And most people just forget about that whole part because it's a part they don't want to know about, because that's the real part that we're talking about when we're saying making your business worth as much as it is. The valuation part, you actually have very little control over it. I mean, Robert, you could go after the same company as me, and if you want to use something like multiples of whatever, your multiple can be one thing. I'm looking at the same company. My multiple is completely different. So that valuation thing is all over the map. It can change every week. You know, the market determines what that is, but the evaluation, that's the part that the seller can completely control. They can make everything look as good as it possibly can, and that's where that infrastructure and the cash flow and all that stuff comes from. The valuation, you have little control. Evaluation, you have a lot. Valuation is eye of the beholder. That's the buyer.
Yeah.
You got to work on the evaluation.
And I think that's what a lot of people, you know, my experience has been is that, you know, the business owner believes that their business is worth X dollars, where someone who's a buyer looks at it and says, well, you know, I'm not prepared to pay that because I can't see, you know, what you see. So exactly the whole idea, and I think that's what a lot of people overlook, is it's what the buyer will pay, and that obviously they have different criteria, but they're also based on what they can do with it, how they can take what you've built or what you're offering and then make it make more money for them.
And that's exactly why kind of have in mind what kind of buyer you're dealing with will allow you to make your company look more like what they're looking for. Again, you have no control over the multiplier they use. And you hit it on the head with the whole, you know, the potential of the company. Like the buyer needs to see their own potential with them at the helm. It has nothing to do with you. That one of the biggest mistakes people make is telling a potential buyer that, well, this company has potential. and that word just puts you in the hole, because then they say, well, then why don't you do it yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why are you selling?
Yeah, the point of the matter is, well, I just made a big mistake and put my foot in my mouth. What you need to be doing is talking to the buyer as in, what is he looking to do? And why is, you know, giving him things to put in front of him so he makes the decision that says, yes, that potential is there. And that's, again, goes back to the evaluation part. They need to see all those things in place.
But I think, that's the sort of stuff you definitely do need. But obviously there's a lot of stuff that you can implement, like, you know, standardizing systems and, you know, documentation, and again, running it like you're going to sell it, running it like it's something that's, you know, run professionally, is going to be far more enticing to someone than who works off the street and, you know, basically sees a mess that they would have to sort out before they started making any money. The people buying it obviously want to step in and start making profit from day one, and the more that you can optimize that so that is the case, the more likely you are to sell it, I believe.
Absolutely. And you know, sometimes it's tough. If you don't want to grow a business past a certain point, like, you know, maybe say 5 people, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But that business better be set up so that those 5 people can do absolutely everything possible to maximize the profitability, which is going to take the business value to as high as it can possibly be. Meaning, if you can get the owner to not be a tech and maybe just be the main salesperson, that value is pretty good. If you get to the point where you can get the business owner out of anything that's necessary for him to be there, he's the visionary, he's the entrepreneur, he's the chairman of the board, he's the president, he's not the head salesperson, he's not a tech, he's not anything that you can have somebody else do, that business has maximized the value as far as that little piece where the, well, it's a pretty big piece where the owner comes into play. So sometimes, you know, if it's a 5-person company, you can't go that far, but you go as far as you can. If it's a 10-person company, that owner better have very little to do what's going on the day-to-day basis. So it's all phases and different steps depending on what business model you have going. You just maximize the best you can in that business model. But people are always disappointed, and they're always going to, most of the time, they're going to be disappointed in the amount of money they get. Mm-hmm. But if you do your initial evaluation of yourself when you're trying to execute the strategy of selling and say, well, what is my business worth now? You got to look at it from the eye of the type of person that you want to buy the business. And you're going to be pretty close. it's not going to be all that far off, but you know, they're probably going to want to pay less. The odds are, but you know, at least if you have some kind of thing that says, at least if you're, you know, within 20% of what would really be the case with somebody on the outside, then you have something to work with. If you're way off, then you're never going to understand what you need to do to make the company worth something, because you're not getting it. Mm-hmm. And that's why you really don't want to do that kind of valuation / evaluation by yourself, because you really can't see what's going on. It's a forest from the trees type of thing. You're in the middle of it. You have skin in the game. It's your baby. Even if you bought it from somebody else originally, you still can't see the true value of the company. You can only see it from your own eyes, which are going to be rose-colored. Same thing with if you use internal people to do that valuation. They're going to tell you whatever you want, not the reality of the situation. And then you won't know what you need to fix.
Yeah, especially, obviously, you know, and you've got to look at external factors like the economy and things like that too, because they play a huge factor in, you know, someone from the outside, for example, coming in to purchase the business.
Absolutely. I mean, at the time we're talking right now, this is a buyer's market, no matter how you look at it.
Mm.
The best business out there is not going to get as much as it would have in the same situation 3 years ago, and probably they'll get more in a couple of years. So, I mean, now's not a bad time, if you haven't done it yet, to prepare, but not necessarily to sell. I mean, it is coming around. It's going to even itself out pretty soon. But this is a time, the good and the bad is, it's a buyer's market, not a seller's market. But because of that, that means that you're going to have more people out there looking to buy at this point. So your buyer pool is much larger.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I think that we're drawing to a close from the amount of time that we've got allotted for today. So in summary, George, is there something that, you know, you can say to sum all this up, or to give us some, the listeners, the idea of what they, you know, that they should be doing with this in mind? Because again, like I said, I found it, you know, very relevant. And again, it's the looking at it from the outside and looking at it from the aspect of running it as a business and running it as an entity that you want to sell and maximize, certainly does help. So any final comments?
Well, I mean, the final comment, I'll go where I started from, is there's no good excuse to not do the run it like you're going to sell it scenario. If you don't want to sell ever, that's okay. Then the question is, do you want to put as much money in your pocket as possible? Because if you're not going to sell it, you got to make your own retirement plan somehow. So there is no excuse to set up the infrastructure and the systems and the processes within your company in the best way possible in whatever business model you want to be in. If it's one person, if you want to be 5, 10, 15, 20 people, I don't care what it is, whatever you're picking, the model as far as that infrastructure and the model as far as what you're selling and who you're selling it to, you need to smooth that out as much as physically possible. Take the money you deserve, build the business value that you deserve, and don't make the mistake of thinking that it's not the right time. The right time to have done this was the day before you start the business. You know, a year before you want to sell it, I'm telling you right now, it's too late. I've helped people do it in a very short period of time, but if you're going to try to structure it yourself, I promise you, going that close is way too late in the game. And like I said before, you can't lose on planning to sell. So you might as well just do it right now, because every day you wait, your profitability and the prospects of being able to sell for a good chunk of change goes further and further into the future. It doesn't happen overnight, and just like anything else, you need to plan for it, and then you need to actually execute on that plan. There's no excuse not to.
Okay. Well, look, that's great. I think there's been a huge amount of worthwhile information that hopefully everybody's able to take on board. So just to round things off, George, if people want to get in contact with you or get some more information about who you are and what you do, what's the best sources for that?
My normal site is consultantscoach.com. That's consultants with an S on it, coach.com. Or my blog is georgesergiomyname.com. And I usually post that about once a week. It's got some pretty informative stuff. And then right there, you can find my email and my phone numbers.
Excellent. Okay, well, I'll take this opportunity on behalf of all the listeners to thank George for coming on and sharing his wisdom. Obviously, we've been able to acquire that for the princely sum of basically just listening. So we appreciate the time that you've taken out of your schedule to do that for the people. Hopefully, we'll be able to get you back on sometime in the future when we broach the business events again. But once again, thank you very much for coming on.
My pleasure, and I'd be happy to do it again.
Excellent. All right. Thank you very much, and appreciate everybody listening, and we'll catch up with you on the next Need to Know podcast. This podcast has been brought to you by the SharePoint Operations Guide. For more information, visit www.wssops.com. To provide feedback on this podcast, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.